Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Amanda Petrusich may be a familiar voice to you. She writes about all kinds of music for the New Yorker. And she's often on our program talking about what she's listening to, what she's obsessed with. And for a few years, she's been singing the praises of a group, or really a solo project, called The Weather Station. Here's Amanda Petrusich.
So my first introduction to The Weather Station, fronted by the singer and songwriter Tamara Lindemann, was incredibly, I think, almost a decade ago now. I am a dedicated diehard fan of folk music in all its varied forms, but for me, a lot of contemporary iterations of the genre can feel a little precious, a little sentimental. And what I love the most about Lindemann's work is that it contained a bit of grit, a bit of toughness. I think the first time I wrote about the band, I said one of the things that I loved about them was it felt like these songs could take a punch to the face.
There was a time you put your hand on the small of my back. I was surprised that you touched me like that. But there in your hand was a current of life. I could hardly stand or stay still.
The Weather Station's new record, which is called Ignorance, is an even bigger departure from that traditional folk sound. And in some ways, it still resembles the folk music that I love so much that I know has been a formative influence for her. But in other ways, it just feels like a whole other universe of sound. Thank you so much for doing this, Tamara. I'm thrilled to talk to you. I'm such a fan, and I find the new record to just be extraordinary. It's been such a gift to have during this time. So thank you for doing this.
Oh my God. Well, thank you so much. I'm really honored to do it.
This should be fun. So with each of your records, I feel like I can hear you kind of gently reinventing your sound and really rethinking all the ways in which a person can communicate through melody and rhythm and silence and language. And I think that feels especially true of Ignorance, which at least for me kind of feels like your biggest, your poppiest record to date. There's almost this sort of late 80s kind of Kate Bush vibe to certain tracks. And I haven't necessarily heard that in your work before. I'm curious if you started writing with the idea of change in mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like there's always the part that I can't take credit for because it was just, you know, intuition. But I think, it just began in, like, I was playing guitar and I wasn't really feeling, I felt uninspired. Like, everything I played, I felt like I was repeating myself. So I switched to keyboard and that changed everything right away. And then I switched to writing with a drum machine, which changed everything. So I got pulled in that direction. But I think that this, like, very emotional, passionate music was the right move to convey this extremely, like, emotional, passionate record, and leaning into some of this pop ideas was really empowering for me, because I mean, pop is where we go for these big emotions.
You've talked about how the deepest emotional experience you had while writing this album was reading the IPCC special report on 1.5 degrees, which is a fairly dense policy report on the impact of climate change. Maybe you could tell me a little bit about what it was like for you to read that report for the first time and how that experience maybe sort of shaped or changed the direction of the album.
Yeah, I mean, if you actually read it, it's like incredibly dense and hard to understand. But, you know, the summation of it, I mean, it is, like I say, I mean, I think I had this really wild experience in 2019, when I was writing this record that a lot of people have had and people call, you know, have given names to it, of just like experiencing climate grief or like experiencing, you know, you've known this your whole life. And then all of a sudden you really realize, and it really hits you that this is going to happen. And like, you know, hundreds of millions of people will die, you know, X amount of refugees, you know, the when you read it laid out, it's so heavy. And yeah, like I had this funny experience with this record where it's like, on the one hand, it is personal and it is emotional and there's relationships in it. But when I was writing it, what I was really truly experiencing was this experience of climate grief. And I feel like people don't, or what, I didn't feel like people would believe me that some of the songs came from that place.
So you're going to perform a song for us. It's called Robber. And I wanted to ask you, what are you writing about here? Who is being robbed and of what?
I feel like it's more like, what am I not writing about? I don't know. I mean, I think obviously we live in a time when the literal future of life on Earth is in peril. And it's so difficult to hold that in your mind and to understand that, you know, there are people who are choosing to make that worse, people with a great deal of power. So I guess that's maybe what I was thinking of the most.
I know, just to sort of make it even more specific, I know you have mentioned on Twitter that you also had, you know, a company or a corporation like ExxonMobil in mind when you were writing about this.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and it's something that I've been thinking a lot about the last couple of years. You know, I was born in the 80s, and, you know, I learned about climate change when I was a small child, and you know, as all of these documents have come out, and this truth of, like, ExxonMobil in particular, and several other fossil fuel companies, that they knew that this was real, that, like, their own scientists discovered it, like, before NASA did, and chose, you know, actively made a choice to create this misinformation campaign and, like, bury the science, like, for their own business model. Like, that to me is just the most insane decision in human history. And I mean, I often think of, if I was a historian looking back, you know, what would I think about the 80s when there was this choice made to do the wrong thing, you know, actively. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I have a small ensemble with me. Evan Cartwright on percussion, Karen Ng on saxophone. Okay, Evan, you want to count us in?
I never believed. Saw nobody climb over my fence, no black bag, no gloved hand. I never believed in the robber. I figured everything he took was gone. Nothing to do, nothing to be done. I never believed in the robber. Never believed in the robber. was young, I learned how to make love to the robber, to dance with the other, to ring from his hand, the touch of a lover. I never believed in the robber. Nobody told me nothing was mine. If nothing was mine, then taking was all there was. Looting at dawn, looting at dusk, hold open the gates for the want of lust. All I saw was the dust.
That's Tamara Lindemann of The Weather Station performing the song Robber. Her new album is called Ignorance. Stick around, we'll be back with more music in just a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We'll continue with staff writer Amanda Petrusich, who just spoke with the songwriter Tamara Lindemann. Lindemann records as The Weather Station, and her new record is called Ignorance.
So you didn't start out your career as a musician. You're a successful television actress during your high school years. I know you acted in some HBO dramas. How did that happen for you at such a young age?
It was all just by accident. I really loved singing. I was in a choir, and then that led me to a community theater. I met a couple other kids who had gotten agents and gotten into TV, and I was like, well, I'll try that. Why not? I just sort of fell into it when I was 13, and I really hated high school, so it was very attractive to me to not have to go to school as much, if I got a job. It was a wild ride. I mean, you know, I feel like there are ways that I'm still like recovering from being an actor. but there are ways in which, you know, I learned things from it and I gained a lot of independence from it.
What were some of those things that you feel like you're still sort of working past or still metabolizing? Some of maybe the bad things that were associated with that career that inspired you to, you know, take this left turn?
Well, you know, I think most of all, having no agency, you know, as an actor, you are a tool, for someone else's imagination, which I think is beautiful, you know, and as a band leader, for example, now I ask other people to do the same for me, to bring their talent and allow me to direct it. For me, being an actor was just strange, and that I had no boundaries, and, you know, people touch you all the time and move your body, and you have no personal space, and you're not allowed to, you know, assert your selfhood. You have to literally embody someone else. So I think for someone, you know, it's a recipe for disaster in terms of like finding your selfhood and being able to, you know, have boundaries.
Right. Especially at that age.
Especially at that age.
As a teenager. Yeah. You've been pretty open on social media about how the income from your work in television, the early work in television, made it possible later on for you to kind of really establish the career in music that you wanted and to sort of stay afloat in that way. Do you think it would have been possible for you to make it to this point if you had not had those early work experiences that maybe allowed you to get a little money in your bank account?
Well, I think that's a really important question, and that's why I wanted to bring that up on social media, because I feel like people don't have a lot of knowledge about how dire the financial situation is for artists in general. And yeah, for example, for me, you know, having that underpinning of, you know, income and savings from working in TV, like, allowed me to, when I started becoming a musician, I had all this freedom that my friends didn't have because they were working, you know, debilitating jobs in bars and restaurants. And I feel like people look at artists and think like, oh, they must be making tons of money. And they're not, like, it, you know, and it's only going to get worse, you know, if we don't figure out a way to monetize art. You know, it'll increasingly be that only artists who have like a trust fund basically can be musicians. And I don't have that, obviously, but you know, even just having that little safety net of like, I can pay my rent, you know, like, I'm not gonna, you know, be homeless if this tour doesn't go well, you know, is a huge, huge safety net that a lot of artists don't have.
Well, I'm so grateful to you for being open about this, because I think, you know, any kind of talk of money, and I don't know if this maybe functions a little bit differently in Canada than it does in the US, but any talk of money is sort of considered very, I don't know, taboo or sort of, it's just ground upon which none of us should tread. And I think, you know, in the end, that protects people other than artists. And from what I understand about streaming revenue and tour economics, it seems, as you were saying, kind of borderline impossible for a new artist to really make a living if they don't have some outside income stream. And I'm curious if you've seen that kind of play out from within the industry, you know, folks who have had to maybe abandon this as a gig because it just was no longer feasible.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people I know, you know, I mean, in Canada, we do have like some grant money that does come into the system. So it's a little less insane than it is in the US. But yeah, for sure. I mean, people, once they have kids or once they, you know, need to make a better living and live less hard, it can be very difficult to be a musician. And the thing that I noticed too is like, I was like a middle of the road actor. Like, I didn't, you know, I was never famous or anything. Like, I was just like a middle class actor. But I made enough money to like save some money, you know, and musicians, even when they're doing so well, I mean, I know a lot of musicians who've been very successful and well known, and all that really amounts to is like 2 or 3 years of being able to pay their bills, you know, and that's kind of crazy.
And I feel like it seems especially kind of acute and urgent right now in the midst of a pandemic when so many musicians, touring musicians and their crews have been grounded. And I'm curious, with touring off the table, what is your sense of how, you know, kind of smaller emerging artists are finding ways to survive these days? Is there another path? Or is it kind of the sad reality that, you know, they're just going to have to get different jobs?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm definitely worried. I mean, in Canada, we've had a pretty decent, you know, government benefit for during the coronavirus pandemic. So that's been really helpful to a lot of musicians I know. And actually, for some people, it's been their first downtime where they've actually had time to work on music because of this benefit, even though it's extremely meager. You know, it's not enough, but it's almost like a, you know, a good argument for basic income. But it's hard to know what the future will hold. Like, definitely I personally see little bright spots like Bandcamp getting so popular.
Maybe you could speak just a little bit about what they've been doing and sort of how they have maybe taken a more equitable or more ethical approach to, you know, kind of dividing revenue between the organization and the artists who make the music.
Well, I think just the difference is that you pay for the record on Bandcamp instead of paying for a subscription. So the money goes directly to the artist or the record label. So, you know, real money comes through rather than, you know, a subscription service. You know, touring being off the table is tough. in a lot of ways, but also it levels the playing field a bit, because touring too is very expensive. And people have this like blank slate knowledge of like, oh, musicians tour to make money. It's like, have you, the budget of a tour is very, very, very challenging. You know, trying to, you know, it's very expensive. So touring too can be like musicians who are already doing well can do it. And musicians who aren't are like tapping into their savings and like going to great financial lengths to tour. So right now there's this beautiful kind of like level playing field where you can put out a record without spending so much money on a tour, which is awesome. But yeah, I don't really know. I wish I knew.
Right. An impossible question, yeah. Of course. And I think everyone who loves music is kind of waiting to see what the world looks like on the other side of this thing. You know, fingers crossed that we make it there sooner rather than later. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your writing process and your lyric writing process in particular. And I think you do it so well, which is why I wanted to sort of ask you about your tips and tricks. You know, getting the feeling or the idea to sort of exist in just a few beautiful words. I'm curious if there's lyricists or, you know, poets or novelists or other writers who you have found inspiration with.
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, I have like, you know, I return to Bob Dylan and Leonard Cohen. But yeah, I feel really lucky to be surrounded in this community in Toronto and Canada in general that actually really shaped me as a lyricist. And I didn't understand that it was unique to Canada. But yeah, there's a ton of musicians like Sandra Perry, Ryan Driver, Gord Downie. Like there's this thread in Canadian music of like philosophical songwriting, Stephen Lamke. And that's how I like my lyrics to be. You know, I like them to be about ideas as well as stories. And I've been realizing lately that that's a product of my music scene, and it's not actually that common in the rest of the world. Most people want stories, they want songs that just tell a story. You know, they don't want the complicated ideas, but I do, so.
Right, and not simply just a story. I think people want autobiography. You know, I think there's this presumption that every time a singer opens her mouth, it should be, you know, it should be coming sort of directly from her immediate experience.
And, right, and I mean, like, and I do write, like, personally and honestly, but I think I've realized something in the last few years that hopefully will make the next few records I write a lot easier, which is that I never was here to just talk about my life. Like, that was never what I was trying to do. I was always trying to do something else. I was always trying to express something more complicated, because the simple songs that are just diaristic never made the record.
Yeah, very cool. So we're going to end on another track off the new album called Tried to Tell You.
Yeah, I mean, I was really just trying to write a simple song. You know, I was thinking of a friend, but then I felt like I was thinking of everyone, of just like wanting my friend and anyone to allow themselves to feel their own mystery and stop trying to pin it all down. But yeah, it's like the most pop song I've ever written, I feel like. But okay, sorry guys, you've been waiting so long. Oh, we've been talking for so long. I didn't realize. Yeah, okay, so we'll play.
I am sorry.
No, I'm great. All right.
It was getting late. You were afraid of yourself, afraid that you might call her, that you could not help yourself. And what could I say? I lifted you all day. I watched her in your eyes and pass across your face like the wind in the water. I tried to tell you that is the way that you want her. I tried to tell you. You're so afraid to try and pull apart the endless rain you thought of as your heart. with blood on your hands from the river inside. You try to deny it. You never felt the tide of the moon pulling closer. I tried to tell you that is the way that you want.
That's Tamara Lindemann performing Tried to Tell You. Her new album, Recording as the Weather Station, is called Ignorance. Lindemann spoke with The New Yorker's Amanda Petrusich.
That was beautiful, and thank you to your band.
Yeah, thank you.
Well. Have excellent weekends, everyone. We'll Friday.
Yeah, thank you.
We made it. All right, take care, everybody. Thank you again so much.
That's it for the show. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.